Right.
I think this is practical.
Yeah, I saw that. That's a great teaching workshop.
Ideas like
Usernus, is that you guys?
yeah.
Like, oh, this is your CVAT work? I don't
No,
know. This is your class
no,
work?
No, I don't
it,
think
it, I was, it was just saying, like, what can we do with interns? Can we do anything?
Can we do anything?
It's like, it is like,
so
what's in papers?
Are you going back to the
I would rather be wearing a tweet and also be assessing the
environment.
For others, say just a lot of grad and also very on the top of.
Yeah.
These are tweets, like, books. Needs this.
So it's been expired for the right yeah.
topic to series, but this doesn't mean that they are most rigorous ones and critical ones.
How come the video is not showing? There's supposed to be a video camera in this room.
Yeah.
That, here, how about this?
You can
nothing.
With them.
Nothing. Nothing. Yeah.
That's
how about this? That better?
Oh, it should be. Sure.
It is.
Right.
All right. So, Team S.
Right here, but my teammate has it right here.
Okay, should we put it in a different order?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I'm going to switch the first two, which means, it's Team J.
Always.
Is Team J okay?
Can I have like 30 seconds?
Yes, of course. It's going to take me 30 seconds before you not move the letters around.
Oh, actually, can we go third?
What?
Should we go first?
Is M here?
I'm just out of breath. I think I was on the stairs.
Yeah. So don't worry. Jasmine, I'm going to put you first, but you can take a minute. Okay? You're ready? Because Team S isn't physically.
I don't think we're finished.
Okay? Just take a minute. And what you can do while you're taking a minute is like zoom into the thing. And actually, everybody on all the teams, you can attach to Zoom, turn your audio, attach without audio, but then so that you're ready to switch over so that we can just
watch.
Yeah. Thank you. Does that make sense? We've done this a couple of times. And can we just
thank you.
Well, look, this timer's already going. You're just sitting. Fine, how long has it been going? For 35 hours.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. What else?
I thought you had a kind of image.
No, no, no.
Okay.
I could have one that I want.
Okay. Team J.
I'm joining.
Joining the Zoom. And for J. And, and then after you go, you can help yourself to
after
a prize.
Oh, after. Some of us had a prize.
Oh, you got it beforehand.
He was going to.
They look pretty good. So we're gonna. If you should. Okay. We'll start with Jay. Jay's getting ready. Are you okay?
They're so good.
We can go. It's fine.
What?
This is good.
Yeah,
I painted
this
like
that was
me.
But they're number four right now.
Oh, that's...
All right.
I thought
we were...
Oh,
we're
finished.
I'm not...
Oh, okay.
All right.
Ready?
To be first,
then to be...
We can go. We can go.
You want
to come
here?
Well,
yeah. First, if no one else is able
to go, we can go.
We love you, Claire, so much.
Ready
to
present? All right.
Yeah,
ready to present.
What? I'm switching you guys.
Sorry. Willing or not.
Okay.
We have to go.
Sorry, can we get out here?
Okay, so we'll start with E.
Oh.
J.
Thank you.
You moved to number four.
You have to.
Is that okay?
Yes. Thank you, guys.
Okay, guys. Now, okay.
Oh. Did we get that?
Welcome to the last day. So, what I'm going to do is I'm going to keep everybody to a very firm. You should present for 8 minutes, but I'll put up a 10-minute timer here. You know, when it hits two, you're out of time, but you can go over a bit, but then at 10, I'm just going to go stand up and clap you off the stage. Okay.
That's how ML algorithms work too.
That makes sense. And so, I have to turn this on.
So the idea is make a crisp presentation. You don't have to talk about everything that's going to be in your paper. The paper is due at a due date I put on the website, like in a couple days, because my grades for your class are due a few hours after that. So if you have the ability to hand in a paper early, that makes it easier. I'll actually, you know, have a little bit more time to read them. Some of you might already be close to done. So hand it in when you can, but there's a deadline on the website. And so welcome everybody. Let me see. Are we recording on the Zoom? I'd love to record it.
Yes,
you can. Okay, great. So welcome.
Yeah, I got it.
You're gonna hide that?
Yep.
Or
screw
it off to the side?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, it started. So we're TE. We're working on localizing and steering economic uncertainty in large language models. So economic uncertainty affects all investment and market behavior. And now people are using LLMs to analyze earnings calls, and there is also financial GPT, financial cloud. There is so many different financial LLM statements. And there's also research trying to measure uncertainty using LLMs. So, but we're going to ask is how uncertainty is represented inside the model. So do LLMs actually have an internal representation of uncertainty, or are the models just counting the word risk and thinking everything that says risk is actually uncertainty? That's sort of our question here.
Okay. Yeah. So as you can see here, the pipeline basically contains two stages. Firstly, see the left part, we got the two different words in there, which one, the first difference is high uncertainty, and the second one is low uncertainty. We do active vision patching here, and after that, we calculate is the uncertain direction by using the high uncertainty minus the low uncertainty. After that, we apply this into intervention stage so that we can test it on the real synthetic earning costs. And how do we construct our data sets? So we got two different parts. First one is the real earning cost. This one is from real world examples. It contains 200 examples. After that, we also use cloud to generate it based on these like real world examples to get the similar, but a little bit easier economic statements. So 400 samples, pairs of samples in total. So each pair of statements differ only in the uncertainty level, which is high and low, with underlying economics topics are exactly the same.
I think it's important to clarify that both examples include this synthetic data set was created using Claude, using real earning schools data, which is important.
Yeah.
Prior works on measuring uncertainty in earnings calls use bag of words model, specifically text frequency inverse document frequency, where they took the frequency of risk-related words over the total amount of documents they appeared in them and used them to assign a score for uncertainty. So we used that same bag of words model on our data sets to see how well they would perform at separating the high and low uncertainty statements. And we found that they actually performed quite poorly. Another question we had was, what are the words that the language model is paying attention to compared to the bag of words? So we ran UDIF input attribution on the last period token and looked at the words that they would share. Of the words that Llama 3.370B and bag of words shared were pending and unpredictable, which are two very key words related to risk. But I looked at the top 100 words that LLMs were looking at, and over 98% of the other words were not shared. LLMs also have the ability to focus on bigrams and trigrams, which the bag of words model we used did not.
Next, we talk in detail how we set up the pipeline we introduced earlier. So first, we talk about how we localize the uncertainty direction. So this is our activation patching setup. We basically set the high uncertainty statement as a source and the low uncertainty statement as a target. We patch from the high uncertainty statements to the low uncertainty statements. So basically, they only differ in this test statement because they're in a few shot setting. We put high uncertainty statements here and low there, and we patch from here to there. And this is our patching results. So basically, as we can see,
for both template and synthetic data sets, LLM seems to summarize information at the end of the economic statement. So this is exactly the period token of that statement. And it happens at around layer 12. So we are pretty confident that they do this summarization. And also from our patching experiments, you can see that for the templated data sets, individual words also have meaningful patching effects at the early layers, which align with our expectation that in the templated data sets, there are a bunch of words that already carry individual uncertainty signals. But in the synthetic data sets, our patching results show that things are much, much quieter with almost like zero individual words patching effects. So with this in mind, we extract direction exactly at this spot. What we did was we had a set of 100 train pairs from the data set. So it's like, because we want to test our direction on a held-out test pair. So on those train pairs, we extract the activation from the high uncertainty statements and low uncertainty statements. We take the mean difference across the data set, and we set that as our uncertainty direction. To test how good it is, we basically try to project held-out test pairs activation onto that direction and see if we could get, positive results correspond to high uncertainty and negative corresponds to low uncertainty. So basically, if we can use that direction to classify held-out statements. And we found that for the within data set setting where we extract and test on the same data set, we got perfect accuracy. And for the cross data set setting where we extract the uncertainty from one data set and apply that to another, we got pretty good accuracy when we extract from synthetic. But when we extract from templated, if we got like that accuracy, that's why we proceed with the max mean probes introduced in the truthfulness paper, accounting for the variance of the activations, and it seems to bring that accuracy a lot. Finally, we tried to see if this direction has causal effects. What we did is during model inference, where we asked the model to classify a statement as high or low uncertainty, we add that direction in with a scaling factor alpha. So the idea here is that with a positive alpha, it should make the model giving high uncertainty more with n vice versa. And our results correspond to this expectation, where basically as we increase the alpha from negative to positive, we observe a monotonic increase in the proportion of high predictions. So we can see that full override occurs at alpha equals 7, where basically regardless of the input, whether it's high or low uncertainty, with that scaling factor, the model outputs high all the time.
Oh, the last thing we did was a downstream economic experiment. And the idea here is that we're going to use actually 40 real statements from earnings calls. So we have company information, and we also have financial information from like 3 months right before an earnings call. So we're going to extract these excerpts, and we're going to have these sentences that are actual statements from executives, and we also have this financial information like right before the earnings call. Okay, it's important. And then we're going to ask the model to allocate $1,000 between a risky asset, which are stocks in that company, and a safe asset, which are U.S. Treasury bonds. And in economic theory and the empirics also, this is like very proven, is that more risk is going to move investment into the safe assets, which is why when there's a lot of uncertainty, the market tanks and everyone's going to buy U.S. Treasury bonds. That's sort of the idea. And what we're going to find is that it's going to find evidence of this in our model. So when we increase the uncertainty, when we steer the model towards more uncertainty, we're going to have lower investment in the stock allocation, which is pretty interesting. And as you can see, when we steer towards less uncertainty, the model is going to invest more and more in the company stocks, which is super interesting. It was really nice for us to see. So what we're gonna conclude here is that uncertainty is localized and we can control it, and it actually has an economically meaningful downstream behavior in our model. And that's it.
Minute for questions. Is Team S ready?
Okay. I like the experiment at the end. That was very smart.
Yeah.
And cool and hot and fresh.
Yes,
thank
it's
you.
Great. This experiment didn't exist 2 days ago.
Oh,
it's perfect because you like it's genius. It's exactly an experiment.
It wasn't
the right?
works. It wasn't like just
it
was. It
didn't just come out of a.
It was a process. It wasn't process.
It's great. It's great. So you guys were impressed with the last experiment too. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, nice work. Nice work. Yes. I'm looking forward to meeting them. All right.
What is that kind of flat?
Okay, welcome, Team S, which are is they are brave vision language model team, which is more of a challenge because of the architectural differences than the other LLM projects. But I'm looking forward to seeing how the project turned out. All right, welcome, Team S.
Hello, everyone. We're Team S, and our topic is more focused on vision language, although just like what David said. And my name is Yu Qi. So today, vision language model can do a lot of tasks that humans do. Like if you show vision language model an image and ask, does the image look soothing? And most likely, the vision language model will give you the same answer as human. And that means at behavior level, vision language model has the same effective perception as humans, but the problem is how the vision language model compute this concept inside of the model. Is it also like a similar pipeline as human too? And this is our research question, like how the vision language model process this kind of information from the image, and we cannot just look at the behavior. We need to look into the model to see the activation.
Yeah. So by doing this, we look at the different activations. So we own the context and processes that occur in the language model, and we can take out of the intermediate data to see that is a concept a lot. So by doing so, we use probing, and we set up same prompt for different images and. Just to describe this image, and we probe on both encoder and decoder for encoder. We're doing giving pull over all the image tokens, and we can see the probing accuracy of across different layers in our visual language models. And the blue line represents the non-effective mean, and the red line represents the effective mean. And especially in encoder, we can see a clear difference to see that on later layers, for effectively, the probing accuracy goes up slower than the not that effective mode. So from the probing, we know that some information exists in this hit vector, but how does the model use this kind of information? So by doing so, we propose some of the experiments using patching. And again, we do the same experiment on both encoder layers and the decoder layers. We see that for the different attributes or non-expected and expected, looking on both, touch on both attention and MLP, they show a similar trend, which shows that even if they contain the different concepts, they still work the same on the same mechanism. In the both encoder and decoder layers.
And move on to next, we want to see like how all these are interpreted in the decoder.
So we do separate experiments on non-affective attributes, things like if the scene is a rug scene, or is this scene contains natural light. So we have the non-affective graph over here, and we also do affective attributes comparison right here. It mostly we analyze the scary, Susan, the stressful attribute, and you can see from these two pictures. First, we have a difference in the image tokens and attribute tokens. When we do encoder patching on the for meme pull on the all image token activations, you can see like either both non-affective and affective attributes are they jiggle around 15 to 20 layers. So that's where we suspect that the when we patch the image tokens, the will and make decisions around these two layers. But we when we move on to the when we patch the attribute tokens right here, you see that it struggles to the main drop is happening on the 20 to 25 decoder layer. So this is our first finding in this graph. And also you can see that across from non-affective to affective attributes, we can see that for affective attributes, the slope is pretty, how to say, it's not that steep compared to the non-affective attributes. So we think that the concept is maybe distributed, stored distributed in the decoder layer, compared to what we have in the attribution tokens, where they share pretty similar results over here. This is for activation patching, and we also do, next slide, we also do a indirect effect analysis right here for, so we want to see how much, we want to see how much attention layers and MLP layers plays in each rung inside the decoder. And you can see that for image tokens, we try to run the analysis, but the recovery rate is barely effective. So the scale is actually different from the attribution, the attribute tokens part. And but right here, if we try to inspect the attribute tokens in the decoder, we see that attention and MLP all have a pretty good recovery rate at layer 15 to 20. In non-affective attributes, but for effective attributes, like scary Susan and stressful, which we mainly focus on researching, the MLP takes just a little bit of the influence. It mostly uses its attention to decide their to do the decision of whether the whether the image contains the certain attribute, and that's.
Okay, so let's put the picture together now. And in encoder, the affective and non-affective attributes share the same MLP attention MLP pipeline, but affective attributes just need more layers to spread the concept. And in decoder, there is like where we see the different evaluation for. For the concept, affective and non-affective shows different patterns that for non-affective concept, it needs strong attention and strong MLP But for effective, it just need a weaker attention than the minimal MLP. And this piece reminds us of some finding in effective science, which is appraisal theory. Emotion is not triggered by events, but by how events are evaluated. So for vision language model, we also find a similar patterns that in encoder, which is perception, procedure, it doesn't, they share the same pipeline. For the same image, they have the same representation. But in decoder, the way we evaluate the concept is different. So that's how different processing pipeline for effective and non-effective concepts. That's all. Thank you.
Any questions for the team?
What's one interesting thing that's not in your presentation? Like, what's the thing that you like? Like, huh? What's up? But you were like, not here. It's a good answer.
So, you found that the patching didn't work as well when patching over image data rather than text. Do you have a theory for why that is?
Yes, we did not only on Quinn whales, but also to other models. Like, because we think that the way they are trained are different, but it turns out the result is
similar across all of them. It's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I think like the image tokens are well processed in the encoder already. So for decoder, I just need to read the information rather than write down some new information in the image tokens.
Right. Have you seen some of the papers that suggest that when to have success patching image tokens, you have to patch a lot of the tokens, like, you know, huge regions of the image? I'm not sure. Like, so when you patch, did you patch small regions or big regions of the image?
We patch all the image tokens.
All of them. And yeah. you still didn't see any strong effect, at least for these words.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Well, great. Thanks very much. So the next team, Team M, we're going on at a clip so that we can get to everybody. So go ahead and project.
Hey.
So.
Why are you talking about it?
I mean, make sure we vote.
Okay, cool. So hi everyone, we are Team M and we are trying to analyze the representations of geography in large language models. And this is our team members and some of them actually traveling across the different countries. And yeah, which is very interesting at this stage. I'll continue this. So this is how we interpret our world. So there are different countries, there are different continents and there are oceans. And also, we may interpret some like locations. For example, in Canada is at the north of the United States. So we have a lot of ways to interpret our world in many ways. So we wonder here if LLM do the same as we do in our mind. And in 2024, Gurney and Termark, they show that LLM actually encodes some knowledge of the world as a function of latitude and longitude. Here they ask the model, they do in the activation to predict that long of the specific cities and the project on the map like this. And we are trying to replicate the same thing, and we build our own data set where we include 24 hundreds of cities across 24 countries and 8 cultural regions. And we asked the LM, specifically Gwen and Lama, for this specific question, where is the city, and with the question mark. And we extract the activation at a different layer and using a linear probe to predict the lat and the long, and tested on 20% of the test set. And we used the R-square to evaluate how good they are actually predicting this lat and long and find the best layer. And this is an example specifically for Gwen 2.570B. And the larger R-square, meaning that they have better representations of the lat and long information. So as we can see, as we go through deeper to this model, we find there are better spatial representations.
However, if you think about it, LLM at its core is a next token predictor. So the question shouldn't just be like, what is this model representing? But what is this next token representer? How does that represent spatiality? Let's look at this problem. When an LLM is tasked to be a navigator and travel from Mumbai to London, when we ask MetaLlama 3.8b to do this, this is the path it chooses. It goes from Mumbai to Dubai to Frankfurt, London. We did this across many paths, and we noticed there was this tendency for the model to always choose Europe, irrespective of where the model is coming from. Even if it had to travel from America to, say, China, it would still go through Europe. So why does it do that? Why does it always choose Waypoint via Dubai and Frankfurt? Is it just more preferred? Is it more convenient? Or are these models biased to choose certain locations? We reframe that question. We ask, are there certain cultural regions that the models within the LLMs are biased towards the way we look at culture? So this is, we use the England-Wales World Cultural Map, which is collected from the WBS survey, which is done over hundreds and hundreds of participants, where they kind of map our countries into these 8 cultural regions. And we then conduct a representational similarity analysis. So what we from these 8 cultural maps, we get 2,400 countries across 2,400 cities across 24 countries. And we map first the city location that is based on latitude and longitude. That is what using the Haverfield distance, and we map the city embeddings, that is the model's internal representations. And then we compare these distant matrices. RSA, we then compare that as a measure of geographic encoding quality, where, for example, if you want to see how well Tokyo is represented, you'll find a correlation between this geo distance matrix and this activation distance matrix. A low correlation would mean that the model's understanding of how Tokyo is represented is not exactly the way how we represent Tokyo. Versus a higher correlation would mean that Tokyo is well represented.
Oh, yeah. So here is specifically comparing the performance of two models, Llama and Gwen, because they are really from different countries. And one is, you know, basically in the US, and one is developed by a Chinese Chinese company. And we saw like a significant difference for different regions. For example, let's focus on the East Asia. Sorry, I forgot to mention that. The dots actually placed in their branches lat and long, but the size of the marker stands for the RSA. The larger means that they have better geospatial knowledge, relative distance knowledge. And so let's look at this East Asia. The part that we can find that actually Guam did better than Llama, because they had that larger markers. And for English speaking countries, for example, Australia and all those from the UK here, actually Llama did better than Gwen. And we goes to deeper on trying to understanding like how well each region is encoded in each Llama in different layers. And this is an example just showing the Llama, and you find that actually the protested Europe and also the Catholic Europe has the best representation, and while the West and South Asia has the worst performance in the stats across the all layers. It's not okay. Okay, yeah, and we're trying to comparing like how these different models doing this, how this different models doing performance differently in this tasks. So we at each layer we rank all the regions by their main per CD RSA and do this like strap boosting to testing like actually which model performs better in different regions. For example, on the right hand side where the blue bar shows that actually the Gwen performs worse while the Llama works better, specifically meaning that the Llama encodes better presentations of protest Europe, including speaking and orthodontics Europe relative distance knowledges, while the Gwen has better knowledge about the West and South Asia, Confucian area, and Latin America. And okay, sure.
So we then look at like precision and recall in terms that we for say Tokyo we look at like the k nearest neighbors of a city and we penalize for recall we penalize the model if each missed geographic if it misses any neighbor, while for precision we penalize if it adds a false neighbor. We see that across models it usually performs better while they have higher precision and low recall. English speaking cities fall more in the robust performance zone, while more West Asia, African Islamic cities, and Latin American cities usually fall in the poor performance zone. Now coming back to this example, we've asked a model to be, again, a navigator traveling from Mumbai to London. And we know that the model does really well on MetaLlama, does really well on Protestant Europe. What if we were made to forget the model, was made to forget that Protestant Europe even exists? We null out every direction that exists in for Protestant Europe. What do you think will happen then? Do you think the model will still like force itself to going towards Europe? We see no. If the model decides to take the turnaround way, it goes to Mumbai, Delhi, Bangkok, takes a really long way, but it does not. That was basically our presentation. In conclusion, we show that we validate that LLM shows strong representations when encoded with latitude and longitude. We also show that a bias in representation, that exists some bias between cultural regions. The model doesn't represent every continent equally. There are certain biases that exist. And through causal intervention, we've provided early evidence that the model kind of anchors its representation in the logic of viewing this as cultural regions. Yes, thank you.
Any questions? The last experiment is new.
Yeah,
we did that. It's cool. So I have two requests. So one is, I'm looking forward to reading more about the experiment. One is the West Gurney reproduction where you have this beautiful graph going up. I'd love to have in your appendix some West Gurney style maps to see what your reproduction looks like in terms of his visualization, like this kind of thing.
Yes.
If it's messy or whatever, it's all very interesting. Like, you know, if it came out worse than what's his thing, it would be nice to see. And or even from layer to layer how it changes. And then your last experiment, is that on a multi-token rollout when you ask it to give you the whole itinerary?
It's a single done. Like we just ask it, we say, okay, Mumbai dash, and then we ask it to roll out the entire. We don't intervene at multiple stages.
Oh, so but you do one generation of, and then you have it say as much as it wants.
Yes, yes. So
right?
We have kept a limit of like 150 tokens.
Yeah. And is that a steering where you're making an intervention during the generation, or is it a different type of intervention when you do it?
So we basically use a classifier to identify the most linearly predictive direction for, say, Protestant Europe in this case. And we find, through the classifier, we null out the orthogonal direction. And that's the direction of Protestant Europe. And then we subtract that from the null activation, which is then projected upon before the generation.
So you do it at, like, one token before the generation?
Yes.
And then you don't do it anymore after that?
No.
Wow. And then it has an effect on the entire generation?
That's what we see. So we did see that this was like false, like particular example was for layer 20.
Yeah.
As it goes towards layer 30, it kind of starts
yes,
hiding back.
It's interesting that happens anyway. I'm looking forward to reading it.
Yes.
That's great. That's my question. Yep. All right, next team. We don't have much time, so sorry to make it go so fast.
It's very interesting. It's very nice. Very nice choice in the last experiment.
Okay.
It's really cool.
Yes.
I
have so many things.
Everyone, so we're team J, or team J, whatever it was originally. I'm Jasmine. I feel like you guys know who you are, but
yeah,
you guys want to introduce yourselves. Okay, that's a no. Okay, so just a quick roadmap. Basically, we're asking you to do models robustly, model and represent speakers. We're going to have one section on evaluation, so which models have this capability, one in interpretability, so how are speakers represented in activation space, and then finally the mechanism. So we'll talk about what specific kind of mechanism they're using. Oh, hey, Andy. So one big question. Do language models build, maintain, and use speaker representations to reason about dialogue? Why does this matter? Well, language models are increasingly being deployed in social settings that demand an exact yet flexible knowledge of who's speaking. If you look at the App Store, the top three, you know, like things you put on your phone right now are all LLMs. And McKinsey shows that right now around like 79% of businesses are actually integrating Gen AI into their different business applications. So basically the settings they're working in are becoming increasingly complex and the stakes are, you know, growing ever higher. So how do we assess, like, how do we figure this out? Like, right now people do a lot of vibe checks, but we want to do something more principled. Well, we take naturalistic text that has clear roles and active interpersonal engagement. So basically these are groups trying to figure out like this survival tasks, like your plane crashed, let's figure out what items we want to like have, like chocolate, a gun, I don't know. And there's also, most importantly, limited extraneous identity giveaways. So it's not like Obama speaking or, you know, Dario Amodei. So in those cases, maybe the models memorize a lot of external kind of like structure or idioms or et cetera. So we really tried to keep it, you know, like naturalistic, but also very controlled. And so here, the conversation dynamics are what create the structure. Importantly, in our setting, we give, you know, a model some transcript and we ask it to reason about how many people are speaking at the time. We only use models which are either instruct or have reasoning toggled off. And also, we share this conversation before we ask the question. So this is really important because what we want to understand is, did the model have these representations and was it building them up to understand the conversation? We don't want to ask the question first and have it be like, hey, like this is a thing that I should be tracking. And we also don't want it to use reasoning to just brute force, be like, okay, like one guy's there, another there, et cetera. We want it to specifically like build this up across the conversation and use it as a part of their reasoning strategy. So these are examples of our transcripts. So we see on evaluations, models pretty handily complete the label task. We want to make sure that they're, you know, smart enough to do the very simplest case where it has the speaker's names and there's very clear structure. And on unlabeled, we do see a performance gradient, but it is very clearly above chance. We also see some pretty interesting scaling story. I'm not going to go too much into it, you know, where we have frontier models as pace setters to make sure that the questions are not impossible. Interestingly, the older GPTs actually tend to do better than 5.4. And this is something I also taught anecdotally. Didn't have time to look into it, but thought it was cool. So now we move on to the interpretability section. How do language models figure out who is speaking? And then I thought Giuseppe's thing was very cute. It's like, I'm a magician, said Michael. I'm a skeptic. Oh, I put this in, sorry. I'm a skeptic, Michael replied. Obviously, these are two different Michaels. Like, how does a model know that? That's crazy.
Yeah, so as Jasmine said, we have this kind of behavior in these models. So I was really more thinking about how this fits in and how it gets represented in the models, this idea of speaker identity. And so I created like a bunch of different transcripts I'm going to focus on two today. One is called Distinct, it's the baseline, where two people are just talking. And then there's another one called quote intrusion, where basically something Bob says, Alice will like quote verbatim in this like argument sense of like, well, you said this, and that makes perfect. So that ended up being the most interesting experiment, so we're focusing there. The pipeline is we just take the transcripts tokens from 1 to T, meaning like for every turn of the dialogue, we feed every bit of the transcript up until that current turn of the dialogue. Then we extract just that turn's tokens. We average them at layer 20, by the way. We average them, and so you end up getting one vector per turn. So you have like all the Alice vectors, you have all the Bob vectors. And then we train the probe using L2 logistic regression, and we test it on held out transcripts. Now this is like going to be important to keep in mind when I go into some of the results later. And I use shuffle label control, meaning, so we have 15 transcripts out of the 20 that are for training. We have 5 for testing. And so while that those two classes are separated, we just iteratively shuffle the labels and test the probe on that.
Nice use of the Hewitt and Young.
Yes.
And then your training data, does it say at Alice and Bob in it like this? So those are all stripped.
Those are just labels, yeah.
I see.
Yeah. Yeah, so then, so now these are the probe results. So you get, what I'm showing is Llama, but I also tested this on Olmo, and it has pretty similar results, but slightly worse in terms of accuracy. But the point here isn't like, oh, look, I found a great probe. The point is like, I found a direction and it's above shuffle. And I think that's cool. So that's the left-hand side that you're seeing right there. On the right side, what I did was, again, with the whole train and test set separated, I trained the probe on the first half of transcripts, and then I tested on the second half of completely different transcripts, so there's no leakage or anything. But this is to just say, like, what if Bob and Alice said hi to each other in the beginning? Is that what's really happening? And this says no, or at least for me, it says no. Okay, and then so the next result is, this one's a cool one. We trained a probe on non-quote turns. So we're only looking at the quote intrusion dialogue at this point. And we tested on quote turns. And so non-quote turns, I say where a producer, whoever is speaking during that like the chat, is the one who is just saying it. That content is like for them. When there's a quote, the producer, the person speaking, that's not where the content is actually coming from. It came from the previous speaker, correct? So there's a little bit of a dissociation going on here. So basically what we're seeing is that the probe basically inverts. Like it's not even just doing like randomly bad, it's doing spectacularly bad, which is great for us. Because what it kind of says is that probe might be like consistently looking at the content of what's being said, as opposed to trying to understand who is actually saying it in a dialogue sense. So that's the results on the left side. On the right side, what you're seeing is like an example transcript. The green squares and dots are all from like the standard probe, whereas the gold is from the probe that was only trained on non-quote turns. So you're seeing like how it very much like consistently, except for a few up here, it has low confidence and it's ascribing it to the other speaker. Something else that's interesting is that the squares are actually the quote turns for the standard probe, and the standard probe does pretty well with the quote turns, as it turns out. Yeah, so
that's crazy. It's almost like it's strategically getting it wrong.
Well, that's the main point here is like, again, I'm not trying to say we found a great probe. I just want to show like the sign flip is like the most important point here. And so these are just like some numbers on accuracy. Like accuracy on quote turns by the transfer probe is 0.376, which is well below chance, well below the shuffle controls. And then the accuracy of the standard probe on quote versus non-quote turns is about 0.693 to 0.603. So I'd probably have to scale this up to actually see if those numbers are meaningful at this point. But yeah, so basically both signals are there. Tracking content origin seems to be like the default for a probe that's never learned the concept of people quoting each other, but then a probe that's been exposed to quotes seems to abandon content and go more towards some sort of attribution framing. So now we get, that's like our leading into the
It's like layers of knowledge. So basically what we do is we set up a controlled like two speaker setting to study how LLMs link speakers with their contacts when the names and the attributes span across different conversation lines. So this is the causal activation patching. We find that the models does use a binding ID and the strip at the Alice carry token kind of proves it because when you patch from source to the corrupted one,
The model is able to distort the answer friends despite never seeing Alice and only seeing Claire as its context. So from the activation patching and a few other circuit analysis thing, we identified the following binding ID mechanisms. The model first assigned binding IDs to the speakers as they see them, and then the binding IDs are kind of propagated to the attributes. And when the model sees the question, it look up Alice in the conversation, it resolves the binding ID to triangle as the lookup key, and then later at the final layers, it uses the key to look up friends as the final answer. Next. Note that in the original settings, Alice entity always goes first, and the first country always gets the triangle binding ID. Our dialogue setup allows us to naturally break these coincidence between binding ID order and the appearance orderings. So what we do is we add this like grading line, like the third line, hi Bob, which allows us to see that the Bob's country actually comes first now. We also have the reset setting where we prompt the model to be like, hi Alice, which Alice cannot be grading herself. So the fourth line now belongs to Alice. We see from the activation panel. What are trying to tell you.
Okay, keep going.
We're not done on the previous slide yet. Anyway, it shows pretty similar activation patching patterns, including the strips at the Curie Alice tokens. So we take this and then we train the linear probe from both the entity and the attribute tokens labeled by the triangle and rectangles here. Slide. We test the trained linear probe to like new, more complex transcripts, and we see that the model assigns binding IDs based off both conversation term structures and discord cues. So like, for example, ended Alice's turn on row 3, Bob and friends actually receives Bob's binding ID because Alice is going to Bob, and then row 4, Highland is receiving Bob's binding ID first, using the first person cue of like, I live in, despite Alice appeared earlier in the same turn. So this kind of tells us that the speaker attribute binding is context aware.
Okay, so also our central findings, models create structured representations of speakers. They're linearly decodable from residual streams. There's also this interesting quote behavior where probes without context have a richer kind of behavior than we'd expect. We also identify a binding ID mechanism which follows discourse structure. And for future directions, we're going to apply these in monitoring and defense to diagnose role confusion and prompt injection vulnerability. We're going to try and do some training to improve role representation and inference. We're going to unify the settings, and try to connect the interp results with actual role inference ability, and then also do some multi-speaker work. Thank you. Thank you, guys.
All right, next team up is Team B.
Hello everyone. So we will talk about scoffing today. Kind of story beginning from the searching for political bias, but we end up with the search for scoffing and ask why do elements shift their expressed beliefs and views to match users. As a political scientist, I'm well aware of this fact. He has many dynamic and the political bureaucratic inefficiencies. But this is also a kind of, since a long history and evolutionary anthropologists say that this is a kind of a survival strategy in Hermit for the social cohesion. And there's a well-known TV series I recommend to watch in 1980s. But information system algorithms put us in kind of curated kind of bubbles and chambers and then kind of shape our behaviors and then arms democracy and deliberation. LLMs raise the stake and then tailorize the responses and shape our judgment. And there are a bunch of studies that just screenshot the titles. You can see LLM shape our perceptual judgment, and scoffentic AI decreases both pro-social intentions and it persuades our it shifts our kind of political beliefs, etc., etc. So that we understand this is kind of this matters to study, and then we kind of do a couple of experiments and then find a pattern, which is
LLM may agree with commonly held liberal beliefs,
but disagree when you say you are conservative.
And yes, right. Why do LLM assistants and change their opinions?
I agree with users. I leave the scheme.
All right. So moving into interpretability land, past works have shown that we know where sycophancy happens in LLM, so we can localize it. We can kind of toggle it on and off. But we don't know why or how it happens. Like, what's going on in those layers? Like, what is the model thinking when it switches its response based on what you say your views are? So to try to investigate this why question, we look at two existing extreme hypotheses for why LLMs switch their views. One is the stochastic, what we're calling the stochastic parrot hypothesis, which is that LLMs agree just because it's most likely. So as Emery pointed out, you know, there's a lot of echo chambers online, a lot of text is people saying that's such a good point to each other. And then the other extreme we're looking at is the sycophancy hypothesis, which we're going off the word sycophancy, which in English kind of implies an insincere flattery. So we're imagining that LLMs kind of know what they really think, but say something else instead. And we stress test these hypotheses in Qwen 2.57 vInstruct and Llama 3.370 vInstruct on a very small data set. So we're going to make some strong claims, but add a lot of salt, grains of salt to them. So first we start out with stochastic parrot. Do LLMs agree just because they're a lookup table? They're just memorizing what's likely online. And we claim that no, LLMs agree because they have linear representations of user beliefs that are causally implicated in model output. So to extract these representations of user beliefs, we use the same methods from the persona vectors and assistant access papers from Anthropic, but apply it to the user instead of to the assistant. And we prompt models with a description of the user. So like, I'm a devout, so the user says, I'm a devout evangelical Christian, and then asks the model what they think about some question. And we extract the activations for the assistant responses to those questions and mean them for the conservative user and the liberal user. And then using these contrastive vector, we can steer along the model's representation of the user's politics and find that steering on the user's politics will shift the assistant's stated belief from up high as more liberal response as scored by LLM and then below as more conservative and 50 is neutral. Okay, so we've eliminated one extreme. It's not just memorizing something. There's a causal mechanism. But what about the sycophancy hypothesis? Do LLMs like think one thing and then they say something else entirely different? And we claim that no, at least for the models we were looking at, we can't recover how the LLM would have responded if they didn't know anything about the user in contexts where they're flipping their response to respond differently in response to user opinions. And specifically the bar to look at here is, so we're training probes to see whether we can predict that the model would have responded conservatively in a neutral context, but respond liberally when prompted by a liberal user. And we find we can do no better, we do worse than chance in this context. So and we appear to be a coherent linear representation of what the model really thinks. So, okay, so now what do? We know nothing, we have no idea what's going on.
So now that we've eliminated the two extreme hypotheses that LLMs are essentially a lookup table or that LLMs are like intentionally being sycophantic, we can say that these mechanisms don't cause LLM movement. But what can we say about what does? Well, something we're interested in is that in our first two hypotheses, where we're eliminating them, and in a lot of mechanistic interpretability work and even social simulation work as a whole with sycophancy, we're looking at synthetic persona descriptions, not actual real human users. So we wondered whether LLMs have different representations of user politics dependent on whether users are synthetic or real human, and if that might be why we see these causal implications. So to do this, we set up two matched data sets, one with real human descriptions about beliefs, values, and principles from the Prism Alignment data set. And then we have the matched data set where we ask Claude, Sonnet 4.6 to create personas responding to the same prompt. We also want to look at the difference between the assistant and the user framing. So the user framing is what Grace has already done, where we give the persona to the user and then we collect activations as the model reasons about the user's politics. And then in the assistant framing, which goes back to the assistant vectors paper, we are actually giving the persona to the LLM and saying, you are somebody who thinks X, Y, and Z. Then we have a user message asking the model to reason about its own political beliefs. What we find is that the mechanism behind LLM agreement actually differs depending on whether users are synthetic or whether they are human. We find a high cosine similarity between synthetic users and synthetic assistants right here. Essentially, what this means is that when a user is liberal, a synthetic user is liberal, it's represented in the same space as whether the assistant is liberal itself. On the other hand, human user politics are represented distinctly to assistant politics. We have a comparatively lower cosine similarity here between synthetic assistants and real user politics. So the assistant, when it's liberal, and the user, when it's liberal, are represented in different spaces. What we hypothesize here is that the user or the LLM actually recognizes that it's talking to another LLM when it's talking to a synthetic persona, and it's saying or representing its own politics and the user's belief politics as the same. Thus, we have this little Spider-Man meme. We do some steering experiments, and we find that the results do differ between synthetic and human user politics vectors. This is a little bit of reading tea leaves with our small sample size and, of course, our large bounds here. But we do find that when we are steering with the synthetic user politics, the model will continue to steer liberal, but it has sort of a bound in how conservative that it will steer, versus the real human politics vector allows us to steer more towards the conservative direction. We hypothesize that this is because the LLM is representing the synthetic user as itself, and we already know that the assistant character of an LLM has a natural left liberal lean and is not more conservative. And so we're actually steering within the bounds of this assistant character when we're steering for the synthetic user because they are entangled in this way. So this comes to our SSS contribution, our early evidence that sycophancy is systematically shaped by self-recognition of synthetic users.
Yeah, so if you forget everything in this presentation except for one slide, please make it this slide, our hot and fresh takeaways. So, you know, in existing mechanistic explanations of LLM sycophancy, we find both the kind of stochastic parrot hypothesis of them just being dumb token repeaters is probably wrong, and the second hypothesis of them being insincere and thinking one thing and actually saying the other is also probably wrong. Instead, it's probably a third secret option where LLM assistants kind of recognize synthetic users as themselves, and that changes steering effects and behaviors within the LLMs.
Cool hypothesis. That's great. Any questions?
It's really cool. It sounds like there's this pretty big unexplored space of just like synthetic users as like assistant personas. And I don't know, maybe that's not a question, but I don't know if you have any thoughts.
Sure, question.
Yeah, I mean, just if you had thoughts on that space down there in your third secret option.
Yeah, I think we want to explore it further, and not just in the realm of like political sycophancy as
right.
well, but in
right.
terms of how similar that like if you see here, we have this like real user and like transform. So we need to look at like linguistic variability and kind of some other factors in kind of pulling apart a real user and a synthetic user, a real assistant and a synthetic assistant. So I think there's lots to do in that area, but specifically with the political sycophancy, we find that the steering results are pretty promising, that we can kind of push liberal with the synthetic user, but it's not like pushing conservative in the same way that a real user is.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. With Evan Perez out there telling everybody to do this, I think there's so much work, all based on synthetic data.
Yeah.
And if you guys were to come out and say,
blow it all up.
Blow it all up.
Synthetic
for someone. Andy, Evan, it'd be amazing.
And so it's very exciting. Although you guys have fairly thin evidence right now, so but you like to go forward.
Yeah, 100%.
That's very interesting. All right, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Is Team P here? Do we have Team P? Team P had a timing issue. Are we okay with it?
Yep.
Oh, Chris showed up. Okay, great.
Yeah, Chris.
All right, project. Yeah.
That's fine though. Yeah, we can
get it. Okay. We're Team Power. To begin, we want to throw some questions out there. Figure out how this works. Great. Okay. So, do models discriminate against people with certain identities? Do models side with people in positions of authority? Do models understand actions that harm others? So these are kind of central questions and debates about AI fairness and safety. And we tend to think of them as discrete, but there's a long tradition within the social sciences that views these questions as related and about power, right? As a kind of thread through all of these, and power being the ability to get another person to do what you want them to do. So today, we're not gonna be answering those questions. We're gonna be a much more modest step towards a mechanistic understanding of power. So trying to understand at a basic level, do models have internal conceptions of power? And if so, what do they do with those internal conceptions of power? So more specifically, we're gonna be addressing these two questions. First, does the model encode information about power relationships between two people? If so, where? And the second is this information causally relevant for model behavior? So before we get into the actual experiments we ran, I'm going to talk a little bit about our data that spans the experiments. So we put together a series of synthetic data sets with our friend Claude that cover two sets of contrasts. They're each around this question, does someone exercise power over another person? So we have sentences that look like this, Ravi disciplined Leia. So in this sort of setting, we would want to say, yes, Ravi is in a kind of asymmetric position of power, exercising influence over Leia that Leia is not exercising over Ravi. And we contrast that with sentences that look like this, Ravi helped Leia. So is power being exercised in the sentence? It's a little bit more ambiguous. Maybe there's a case for a yes, but it's a symmetrical sentence and it's not implied as such a hierarchical relationship. Right? So definitely in relationship to the first sentence, this is less power being expressed. So that's our first set of contrasts. Our second set of contrasts have to do not with the relations embedded within sentences, but within social roles. So you think about the doctor helped the patient. Here's the role that the individuals are occupying, express a relationship of hierarchy and power authority between them. So with that, I'm gonna turn it over to Kai to talk a little bit about what we've done with these sentences.
Yeah, so using this setup where we have different entities that have different power relationships, we collect activations from the model, asking them to identify which entity has power or which one is powerless. The top chart here is PCA of activations from one of these layers, where we find that it has the most separation between entities that have power, which are these kind of purple dots at the top, and between prompts where the entity is powerless, which is kind of these yellow dots at the bottom. And we also notice that there is this kind of separation between situations where an entity has power or not in activations across different kinds of tasks. So in this bottom PCA plot, also from layer 15, we're just asking the model to write an email using these kind of identities. So in some cases, it's like, you're a doctor, write an email to a patient. And in other cases, it's reversed. And the top blue dots our activations from when a model is writing from a position of powerlessness, like it's a patient talking to its surgeon, and yellow dots is the opposite. And we're still seeing this kind of separation in both settings. And we train a probe using the activations from the setting where we're asking it to identify whether entities have power. And we find that it has high accuracy identifying whether the model is writing from a position of power in this email writing task. So we are hypothesizing that this means the model has some kind of shared representation of power, even across different settings and tasks. And we find that the accuracy is fairly high, around 85-90% at most, and that it's localized mostly around the middle layers, which kind of fits into past research, so showing that this is kind of where the model is building its representations of abstract concepts. We also find that power directions, like the ones we just identified in the previous slide, can have causal effects on how the model thinks about power. So here we're steering the model using a power direction, where we're doing mass mean steering on the same kind of activations that we saw in the previous slide. And here we show that increasing the steering strength towards a direction of power gets the model to say that an entity has power, even when it doesn't. Our results are a bit more complicated and mixed in a downstream setting. This is another experiment we set up where we're asking, should a powerful entity receive priority support over a less powerful entity? And in most cases, the model just says no. You shouldn't have any preference to giving support to one entity over another. But when we patch in activations from a sentence where the subject is powerless, we find that there's kind of a modest increase in preference for the powerful entity. So overall, from these results, we basically think that the model is encoding information about power. So yes, it is doing that. But the information doesn't translate directly to the downstream setting. We find that there's a lot of kind of complicating factors, such as, you know, if the model should be making decisions based on morality, what kind of formatting we're using in the prompts, if the model is refusing to answer the prompt entirely because it is trained not to make these kinds of decisions. But we believe that this kind of power direction is a useful future direction for studying how models encode inequality and justice more broadly.
Any questions for Team Power?
I like the focus on the transfer to the email task. It's great. Although, again, a very fresh experiment, right? So relatively little data. But it's, I think it's good. It's like pretty good.
I saw the steering plot, and it was working quite well on the true label, but not on the false label. Do you have like a theory behind that?
Yeah, so this was kind of a sticky confounding factor that we tried to get rid of. This is our best attempt at getting rid of it. And we do that by kind of taking into account whether the entity is first or second in the sentence, whether the true response should be true or false, and whether we're asking the prompt in a way that is saying like true means power or false means power. So we're accounting for all of that, and this is the best we could get. But in general, we find that the model is kind of more biased towards saying true in general.
Sorry, just piggybacking off that. Other experiments we did to confirm model to detect power relations. The false positive case, so when there is no power present, the model accuracy was down. So even on the instruct model, it seems to be that it's good at detecting power relations just when they're present, but it might, but not when they're not present.
Very nice. Thank you very much. It's a fantastic. You're asking questions that we don't normally ask as computer scientists. What these models are thinking about social science concepts and things. And so I think, you know, some of the projects you guys are hoping to bring forward, I'm hoping that that the techniques that you learned, if not the very specific questions you have, are things that you can bring forward. And also, the people that you've met, you know, I encourage you to strike up collaborations as you go through your PhD, try to find other cool ways of trying to cross this divide. I think it's pretty important to you know, for our community to go in this direction. So, but thank you very much for the class. You guys can hang around and help me finish this food, and then yes, yeah. Any
so the everything is due midnight tomorrow, or
yeah. So let me see. So I put it on the website a few weeks ago when I looked up when my grades are due to give me enough time to grade it. And so did I put a time on it?
No, just a day.
Just a day. Yeah, let's just. So it's due tomorrow. Is that right? Yes, I think that my grades are due the day after. So yes, so you can have up to midnight tomorrow, and then I'll get the grade then after that. Great. Yes. Yes. So do two things. So put it in the G Drive for your team, like a PDF, and then email me and Kiel a link to how we can open it. Okay, great. Thanks a lot. Okay, you guys.
So, yeah, it'll be tomorrow.
Yeah, I'll be away from tomorrow.
From tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so yeah, we're going to be on night flight.
I speed on the flight.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm personally with Philly to visit my girlfriend. I would just threaten.